Well, I appreciate that introduction. You know, somebody earlier suggested this was kind of like the Dead Preachers Society. And yet I want to suggest to you that these men, though dead, really are in many respects yet living. In the memory of some of us that are here that heard these men speak and teach and preach, but also through their writings. And they're very, very interesting people. If you think about the Bible is essentially a book of biography. Most of what you find in the Scriptures is biography. And to me, the Scriptures build to that great crescendo in Hebrews chapter 11 where he talks about those great men of faith who wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, destitute, afflicted, ill-treated, of whom the world wasn't worthy. And many times when I study the lives of those figures connected with the Restoration, I have a very similar feeling. Yet I also always know that they were human beings. They made mistakes, they did great things, and sometimes things that were not so great. And so it's always important to remember that, as Paul says, all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. No matter who we are, we're not perfect as human beings. My interest in Foy Wallace began really when I was a fairly small child. My father had a very deep interest in Brother Wallace. We had all of Brother Wallace's books in our home, and I can remember when I was about 10 years old in 1966 going to a meeting where Brother Wallace was the speaker. Max R. Crumley was the local preacher there. This was in Albany, California, in the San Francisco, Oakland Bay Area. And the photograph that we have to begin our presentation is a photograph taken by Max Crumley's son, Max Crumley Jr., who was a very, very fine photographer. Well, this sort of fueled my interest in Brother Wallace, and I found out very early on that Brother Wallace was not a simple man. He was an interesting person, but he certainly wasn't a simple person. I was interviewing a number of years ago Joe Gilmore, a preacher out in San Jose in the San Francisco, Oakland Bay Area, and he said, "Terry, I want to tell you a story about Brother Wallace." He goes, "It was during the Second World War," and he said, "Yeter, Tant, and I were going to be involved in a meeting. Tant was to preach, and he said I was going to lead the singing. We were visiting with the Wallaces somewhere in California, and when it came time for us to go, it was during the war, and we were going to take public transportation. And Brother Wallace said, I've got an old Cadillac, and I have gas coupons, and we can drive you to the meeting, and you all can just stay, and we'll visit for another hour, and then we'll get you to the meeting." And so they did that. Well, when they got in the car, Brother Wallace was driving, and Sister Wallace was riding shotgun, and in the back seat was Joe Gilmore and Yeter Tant. And as they were driving along, Sister Wallace began to give Brother Foy grief about his hat. He had an old stockman's cap on that looked like it had, you know, been tromped on and just didn't look too spiffy. And she started to say, "Now, Brother Wallace, here we are with these two fine dress preachers in the back seat, and there you are with that ugly stockman's cap. That's just the ugliest cap that I've ever seen. I cannot believe you're wearing that cap when we have these two fine dress preachers in the back seat." And so it went for about a minute or two. And Brother Wallace never replied at all, and finally he rolled the window down, took the cap off his head, threw the cap out the window, rolled the window back up, kept on driving. And from the back seat, Tant said, "Thank God you weren't criticizing his britches." Well, that tells you something about the character of the people. Brother Wallace was not a simple man. Melvin Wise called Wallace the Alexander Campbell of our age. Ira Y. Rice Jr. called Wallace the preacher laureate of the 20th century. Tant wrote of Wallace, "I had an unlimited admiration for him and prized his friendship beyond measure." Wallace also, though, had some sharp controversies with individuals, including Rex Turner, who was involved in founding this university. And yet, when I interviewed Rex Turner, one of the things he shared with me was that he and Brother Wallace had come to be very good friends once again. And in 1996, Rex Turner said to me, "I esteemed him highly." I've said of Brother Wallace, he was the most loved of preachers, but also the most hated. He was called the kindest of men, also called the most bitter. He was praised for his patience and condemned for his impatience in the superlative degree. He is clearly the most influential preacher in Churches of Christ in the 20th century. People tend to, though, either be all for him or completely opposed to him. There are very, very few people in the middle. I want to share with you, and we have such a brief amount of time, he lived a huge life, he wrote many, many books, he wrote hundreds of articles, but I want to try to give you a little taste or flavor, I guess, for what this man was like, and how I think in many ways he still influences us. And so we're going to endeavor to do that in the few moments allotted to us this morning. He was born into a family of preachers. He was the son of Foy Wallace Sr., who was a very well-known preacher in Texas. He had immigrated to Texas from Alabama. So Foy Wallace and his people were originally from Alabama, and I haven't studied the history or sent Scott out enough to know what dead relatives Brother Wallace has here in Alabama, but he's definitely got them. In this particular picture, there is these are the Wallace children, and the young man, as you're facing the screen in the upper right-hand corner, is Foy's brother Cled, and to Cled's right, as Cled looks at you, is Foy. And the sisters, Willie Wallace, who married Dean Speck of Abilene Christian University in Tempe. This is a photograph of the family kind of all grown up. The tall young man in the middle is Foy's brother, Cled. And again, as you look at the screen from the audience, the young man to the far right is Foy Wallace Jr. In 1909. He was born in 1896. So Brother Wallace was very much an 18th century person. And then his parents, of course, are in the front. This is a picture of Foy when he was in college. He went to college at Thorpe Spring Christian College. His brother Cled had also gone there briefly. Cled was the oldest of the Wallace children. Foy was known to remark on occasion that he and Cled were only distantly related, as there were two girls between them. In point of fact, Cled was born in 1892, and Foy was born in 1896. The two brothers were very, very close. Foy Wallace, writing of his relationship with his older brother Cled, said, "When we were on the school ground as boys, if a big bully jumped on me, Cled said, 'All right, but you'll have to take me too.'" And he said, "He's still the same big brother. If you don't want to whip too, stay off us both." And that was very much the attitude that Cled always had. At Thorpe Spring, Wallace was 16 years old. So this is a picture of a fairly young Foy Wallace Jr. He lived with Batsel Baxter, not to be confused with Batsel Barrett Baxter, who was Batsel Baxter's son. But he was so young that he lived with the Baxters. Wallace was always very close to the Baxter family, as indeed was the entire Wallace family. When you think about Wallace's background, it really came primarily from his association with his father, Foy Wallace Sr., his association with Cled, his association with older preachers like Batsel Baxter, C.R. Nickel, and R.L. Whiteside. Those were his main influences. He used to quip he'd hardly gone to college at all. Somebody once asked if he had gone to Thorpe Spring College. He said yes, he had attended one day to take Cled's lunch. That wasn't too far from right, but he actually spent one year at Thorpe Spring Christian College. He begins preaching full-time in 1912. So at 16 years of age, he goes everywhere preaching, and he had one of those personages where he looked younger than he was. He wasn't a very tall man, about 5'4" or 5'5". He dressed in knee pants, and part of his immediate appeal as a preacher was he was able to preach completely without notes from the very first time he began to preach. He had been taught the scriptures as a very young man. He'd memorized large portions of the scriptures. He'd memorized large portions of other things as well that he wanted to quote. So if he wanted to quote a poem, he was able to do those things without notes. And so very, very early on, he is a very charismatic figure. He has the ability to reach people in a way that most preachers cannot, and certainly most 16-year-old preachers. And he preached in knee pants until about 1921, still being advertised as the boy preacher. Austin Taylor often led singing for Brother Wallace, and he reminisced about the early days as Brother Wallace's song leader, and he said this, "Foy Wallace and I have blazed the trail throughout 8 different states, and in a few places there have been more than 100 people baptized while I stood by singing, 'Oh, Happy Day.'" 1920 was one of those banner years where one of those meetings took place at Lomita, Texas. Wallace baptized 100 and 49 were restored. And Wallace wrote this about the meeting: not one under 16 years of age was in that number of baptisms. So 100 adults, 16 years and up. 1920, he held a gospel meeting at Abilene Christian College, and George Klingman wrote this about Brother Wallace. He said he studies the Bible carefully, and he speaks in an attractive and pleasing manner with a distinct message based on strong convictions in God and His holy word. His appeals to the unconverted are irresistible. 41 people were baptized during that meeting. So when you think about Brother Wallace and his life, much of the first 18 years of his preaching career are spent as this very dynamic evangelist. 1923, he made his first trip east of the Mississippi River. And he goes to the city of Nashville, invited by S.H. Hall, who's in the photograph to your right as you're looking at the photo from the audience. Brother Wallace in the middle and Austin Taylor, his great song leader, to the left. So 1923, he makes his first appearance in Nashville, Tennessee, first time to preach east of the Mississippi River, and he preaches at Russell Street, which is one of the major congregations in Nashville. And among the members of Russell Street are J.C. McQuitty, who owns the Gospel Advocate, and his son Leon B. McQuitty, who will soon own the Gospel Advocate. 1923 is his first meeting. A second meeting takes place in 1924, which is when this photograph takes place. And this is what S.H. Hall said about Wallace's meeting. He said, "It's the only revival that I've ever been in, that it seemed that the crowds hindered the work. It is estimated that some 600 or 1,000 were turned away for lack of room. The house was packed at least three services the last day of the meeting. And at the final night service, it was considered that more than 2,000 were in the building and hundreds turned away." A pretty remarkable meeting, to put it mildly. And of course, you can imagine if you were the McQuitties witnessing the impact and the effect of these meetings. Wherever he went, he was having these tremendous meetings where dozens and dozens were immersed into Christ, and sometimes they went into the hundreds. In 1927, Brother Wallace went to Southern California, held his first meeting on the West Coast. And the brethren there were so impressed with that meeting, and you see on the screen a meeting card from that meeting. This was postcard size card. These sorts of meeting cards were often used, sent through the mail to invite people to the meeting. And so he holds his first meeting in Los Angeles. The brethren were so pleased with his work in that meeting, they called him to Los Angeles, and he did really one of his few located works there. While he was in Los Angeles, he got to know T.B. Larimore very well. And he visited Brother Larimore a number of times as Brother Larimore was dying. Those of you that have studied history may know that Brother Larimore, who was the founder of the Mars Hill Bible School, had moved out to Southern California, spent his old age there, and died in Santa Ana in 1929. Foy Wallace Jr. was one of the pallbearers for T.B. Larimore. The meeting at Russell Street that I'd mentioned a minute ago in 1923, where Brother Wallace is preaching for the first time in Nashville, sitting in an armchair just a few feet from Foy Wallace Jr., E.G. Sewell. So this is someone who knew most all of the second generation restoration leaders in person, and for whom many people still living knew Brother Wallace. So he's kind of a key pin person. I threw this photo in just for the attorneys that might be in the audience. If you are looking for a personal injury claim, this might be helpful. This is taken at Lookout Mountain in Chattanooga, Tennessee. They will not let you climb up on the rocks the way the family did in that photograph. And you can thank your friendly neighborhood attorney for that. Well, in 1930, while Wallace was still in Los Angeles, California, he was summoned by Leon B. McQuitty to move to Nashville, Tennessee, and to become the editor of the Gospel Advocate. Foy Wallace was 33 years old, and he takes over the Gospel Advocate, a paper that David Lipscomb and E.G. Sewell had edited together for 50 years. And so you think about what a remarkable thing that was for somebody who's 33 years old. David Lipscomb had only died in 1917, and Brother Sewell had not died until 1924. So here he is, appointed the editor of the Gospel Advocate. And you might be asking, well, had Brother Wallace edited a paper before? And the answer is no. You might say to yourself, well, had Brother Wallace had lots of debates? And the answer is no. He'd had two debates prior to becoming the editor of the Gospel Advocate. Well, you might say he was well known across the Brotherhood as a writer, and the answer again is no. He'd written 10 articles in his entire career. So 18 years, he's basically an evangelist, and it's because of his work as an evangelist that he gets the opportunity to become the editor of the Gospel Advocate. It's not for any of the normal reasons that we might ordinarily think about. This is a copy of the very first issue of the Advocate that he edited, and he begins with an editorial on the front page called An Open Door. He does overall work that was fairly universally acclaimed during his 4 years as editor of the Gospel Advocate. Most of his articles are really on what I would call first principle type kinds of subjects, but he begins to write about 1932 on premillennialism. And of course, there had been a problem in the church related to premillennialism that had gone all the way back to 1915. R.H. Bull had been the front page editor for the Gospel Advocate, and he began to write on millennial theories. The senior editors of the Advocate had tried to dissuade him from that, and they had been unsuccessful. My own belief is that a lot of why Wallace began to tackle that particular topic had to do with his association with F.B. Shrigley. F.B. Shrigley had an office just down the hall from Foy Wallace Jr. At the Gospel Advocate. F.B. Shrigley was the senior member of the Advocate staff, and F.B. Shrigley was completely opposed to premillennialism in every way, shape, or form. And while the battle had gone on for 10 or 15 years prior to Wallace's involvement in it, Wallace brought something different to the battle, which is this very charismatic, dynamic personality and the ability to draw the issue. This is the reason why people loved him or hated him. You see, it had to do with what issue in particular that he was drawing. And so he was very, very effective at, somebody wrote Wallace once and described what he had done on premillennialism as fireworks. I mean, he did it in such a way that it made an impact. You knew what he was saying, and you knew how he was saying it, and there was no misunderstanding about what was being done. Well, this generated Wallace a lot of support, but it also generated Wallace a lot of enemies. There were a lot of people who had always loved Brother Wallace before and who now really became his enemies as a result of what was going on. And while Wallace continued to do some preaching while editor of the Gospel Advocate, going from place to place, this is a meeting that he held in I believe it's Kansas. Basil Duran, who's a good 12 inches taller, it appears, almost, than Brother Wallace, was his song leader. Somebody mentioned Adrian Duran in the first hour, and this was Adrian's brother. Basil Duran was a very, very fine song leader. So Wallace continues to hold meetings in 30, 31, 32, 33, 34, but we're in the middle of the Great Depression. And a lot of the brethren thought that Leon McQuitty was paying Brother Wallace a lot of money. And, of course, Brother McQuitty thought that Wallace was earning a lot of income from preaching, and neither thing was exactly true. In addition, there were a number of health issues that struck the family. And Wallace himself, by 1934, was in need of serious need of hernia surgery that he really could not afford. And, of course, there was no medical insurance. You know, people have a big controversy in the country currently about medical insurance. Well, there wasn't any medical insurance in 1934. You just had to pony up. So Wallace ended up in fairly severe financial difficulty. And so in 1934, he declared bankruptcy. He resigned as editor of the Gospel Advocate at the same time, and he reaffirmed his debts. Reaffirming your debts simply means he promised that even though he was declaring bankruptcy, that he would repay those debts. And he did repay the debts 3 years later in 1937 with the help of J.W. Aiken, who was a family friend and a wealthy Texas oil man. Went back to Nashville, repaid every single debt, and there are receipts extant for all of the debts that Brother Wallace repaid in 1937. But from then on, wherever he went, one of the things that his enemies would say was he was not honest in business because he had declared bankruptcy, and they would, of course, tend to leave out the fact that he had repaid his debts. 1938, he began the Bible Banner. In between the Advocate and the Bible Banner, he briefly, for 8 issues, edited a paper called the Gospel Guardian. But the better-known paper is the Bible Banner, which was begun in 1938, and it continued for the first couple of years his attacks on premillennialism. However, 1941, and this is part of what he and Brother Rex Turner got sideways on, the Second World War begins. And Cled Wallace had always believed that Christians could participate in civil government. It was mentioned earlier that David Lipscomb was unalterably opposed to Christians' participation in government. And Brother Lipscomb had a very consistent position. He didn't pick and choose. For example, Brother Lipscomb would not vote. And Brother Lipscomb argued with some force in the pages of the Gospel Advocate that if you voted, your vote was worth nothing if not backed up by the bullet. In other words, if there was no force back of a ballot, that ballot was worthless. Brother Wallace, along with his brother Cled and R.L. Whiteside and C.R. Nickel and a number of very prominent preachers, argued when the Second World War began that Christians could participate in civil government, that they could be policemen, that they could be soldiers, including being combat soldiers. Well, this was another major controversy, and a lot of the brethren, and to be completely candid, especially a lot of the Alabama brethren, were unalterably opposed to that idea. John T. Lewis, who did a great work in Birmingham, who was a close personal friend of Foy Wallace Jr., very much took David Lipscomb's position on civil government, and Rex Turner as well. And if you go back through the old issues of Sound Doctrine, the first run of that paper in the late 1930s and early 1940s, you'll find a number of articles that one might characterize as somewhat harsh, attacking the Wallaces and their views. One of the things, for example, that was said in 1944, Cled Wallace, Foy's older brother, had a son who was declared missing in action over Germany. And in fact, he'd been shot down over Prague, Czechoslovakia, and was a casualty of war. And one of the things written in the religious journals was this was God's judgment upon Cled for not teaching his boy the proper view of civil government. That's how intense it got. So the Wallaces defended the rights of individuals to serve in the armed forces during the Second World War, and this, of course, generated some more friends and some more enemies as things went along. But they dealt with that issue, and Wallace later put out a book called The Christian and the Government, which dealt with the issue in a good deal of detail. I think it's probably the strongest book. If you want to find something that is in favor of Christians participating in civil government, it's probably about the strongest thing written. And it's not just Wallace's articles, but it's articles from Cled Wallace and C.R. Nickel and R.L. Whiteside, and it's analysis of both David Lipscomb's book on civil government as well as some of the work of John T. Lewis. So that sort of takes us on into the 1940s in Brother Wallace's life. And as things progressed on, we come to sort of a third phase of Brother Wallace's life that begins about 1952. Brother Wallace's wife suffered a stroke. And as a result of that stroke, she was at least partly paralyzed for the rest of her life. And Brother Wallace put all of his meetings on hold, and for about a year and a half did nothing except tend to his wife. And for the first thing he did is he took her to a homeopath down in Corpus Christi, Texas. And then he heard about the springs in Arkansas, hot springs. And so he took her there and did everything that he possibly could to assist her so that she could recover as much as possible. And in point of fact, she did partially recover. And from then till the end of Brother Wallace's life, wherever he went, he took his wife with him. I can remember talking to Roy J. Hearn a number of years ago, and he told me about one of the very first meetings that Wallace held after Sister Wallace's stroke was where Brother Hearn was the preacher. And he said he brought his wife with him, and he said, "Terry, I've never seen anything like it." He cared for his wife just like she was a little baby. And so, you know, one of the interesting parts of Wallace's personality is the incredible care and love and devotion that he showed for his wife from 1952, the time she suffered the stroke, until he passed away in 1979. One of the other things that, of course, took place as you moved into the 1950s was the institutional conflict. And, of course, Wallace had written some things on institutionalism that some people thought that he was going to be very much opposed to any form of institutionalism. And this is a quotation from his book, The Certified Gospel, Second Edition, published in 1937. So this is, you know, quite a while before the institutional controversy. But this is what he said: "Today any man or any group of men can start any institution they please to start, put it in a benevolent basket, label it your baby, place it on the doorstep of the church with the appeal of please take care of it. This is taxation without representation. Again, I say the delegate system of the digressives is better than that, for in that case there would be some voice in what is started. The church is about to become the unwitting and unwilling victim of institutionalism, and institutionalism is about to become a racket." Well, a lot of people took that statement and other statements from Brother Wallace to believe he was going to be opposed to any form of institutionalism, and he ended up with a more complicated and somewhat nuanced stand on it. And a lot of what he really had to say about it was, you know, there was institutionalism that was bad. There were situations where people were simply creating projects to foist them on the church, and these things weren't good. But he also saw that there was a place for institutional orphan homes. And as the battle developed in the 50s, he became really very concerned about attitudes and activities on both sides of the question. And this is an article that he wrote in 1959, appeared in the Firm Foundation, called Paper Yokes and Party Labels. And this is what he said at that time. He said, "In this free-for-all melee, the discussions have descended into arguing the latest whims of the disputants, and a logomachy of words, a war of words, which demoralizes the church within and degrades it without. It has become a ridiculous caricature of the polemics of Christianity. It presents a sordid spectacle. It is a sorry concept of defending the faith and advancing the cause of Christ. Consider the ignominious exhibitions of public debates between brethren on whether it is scriptural for a congregation to perform a humanitarian service to someone not a member of the church, or whether it's right for an able church to help a weak one maintain a preacher among them. And to make such whims the wedge of division in congregations, to the confusion of all the members, such forensic episodes are not ameliorating to the disturbed state of churches generally and cannot be the solution to any crisis that exists in congregations locally." So there he was again, and whether you want to agree with Brother Wallace or disagree with him, he was very, very direct, as he usually was. That is a very brief overview of Brother Wallace's career. There's so much more that could be said, and there's a few other things that I will try to at least briefly touch on about Brother Wallace and how he did some of the things he did. One thing that I want to mention, a lot of people commented on how Brother Wallace preached without notes. That doesn't mean that he didn't have notes. Typically, when Brother Wallace would prepare a sermon, he would carefully outline that sermon before he would begin to speak. And then when it came time to preach, he'd memorize the sermon outline. And so he would speak without notes. And, of course, many of these sermons he had preached many, 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 many times. I've gotten to know four of Brother Wallace's five children. The oldest son, Austin Taylor Wallace, died before I started my work on Foy Wallace Jr. And one of the things they shared with me was, of course, because their father had preached these same sermons over and over and over again, that the family had them memorized. So they would sometimes be sitting in church, and they would come to kind of the key point in the sermon, and Sister Wallace would nudge one of the kids and say something to the effect of, "Here it comes," right? They knew what was going to be said. Brother Wallace's oldest daughter, Leella, who is 91 years old, still living and in reasonably good health, living on her own, told me that sometimes her father, as he would preach these sermons, that she'd already heard 20 times. And of course, Brother Wallace sometimes preached a little bit longer than the average preacher. She said that she would want to be able to, you know, to get out of the situation. So she would lean over to her little brother, Wilson, who was a very sweet-natured child. She said he took after the Brightwells. The rest of us were all Wallaces. So she'd lean over to her little brother, who's about 8 years younger, and she'd say, "Wilson, you're adopted." And Wilson would begin to cry, and then her mother would say, "Leella, take Wilson out of there," which was of course exactly what she wanted. We're gonna test one other thing. You know, I can tell you about Brother Wallace, but to actually hear Brother Wallace in his own words may be a little bit more effective. Here he's. This is from a sermon called "Remember the Words of Christ," one of his best-known sermons. And he's talking about the importance of being able to at the right time call up the scriptures. And he's telling about a brother who had been in Salt Lake City, Utah. So we'll see what happens here.
I had that forcibly impressed upon me by a true story of a well-known preacher years ago, one of the older preachers in the church who went to Salt Lake City, and standing off to one side looking at the Mormon temple, a Mormon tapped him on the shoulder and said, "My friend, God dwells in this temple." He did not make any reply of his own. He remembered some words in the text, and he said, "The God that made the universe and all things therein, He being Lord of heaven and earth, dwelleth not in temples made with hands." There wasn't anything to say about that. He dwelleth not in temples made with hands. I went to Salt Lake and wanted to go into the Mormon temple. They wouldn't let me in. They told me I wasn't a saint. I started to read some passages on what a saint is, but it occurred to me all at once that so many of my own brethren agree with the Mormons about my not being a saint. I decided not to introduce myself to faith, and so I skipped it. But
well, that gives you a little bit of an idea. You know, how can somebody preach for an hour and a half or 2 hours and hold the audience? And while I wouldn't say that Wallace was universally successful in holding the audience when he preached long sermons, he did have an ability to intersperse humor, and that humor was often, at his own expense. He had a way of trying to cut through sophistry. Wallace, in his entire life, only held 13 debates. A lot of people think about Foy Wallace and they think, well, this was a guy that was just a debater and a controversialist. Well, he only held 13 debates, two before he was editor of the Gospel Advocate. Probably his greatest debate was a debate against J. Frank Norris, who was a fundamentalist Baptist preacher in Fort Worth, Texas, had a congregation of some 8,000 individuals. And this debate took place in 1934, and this will give you another idea of Brother Wallace's use of logic. During the debate, they were arguing about Mark 16:16, "He that believeth and is baptized shall be saved." And J. Frank Norris was saying, you know, per that passage, the essential thing is you've got to believe. But whether you're baptized or not is incidental. And Norris said it's like this: whoever gets on the train and is seated shall ride to Chicago. All right? Getting on the train is essential, but whether you're seated or not is incidental. You're still going to get to Chicago. Now, most of us would want to like diagram the sentence and point out that that's not the right way to look, you know, to understand that phrase. What Wallace said was, "Friend Norris, Baptists teach that the instant you believe, you are saved. So the second you get on the train, you're in Chicago and you don't have time to sit down." That's what we mean, you know, when we're trying to talk about drawing the issue. There are a lot of other things that we could say, and there's at least two other things I want to make sure that I share briefly. And this has to do really with Wallace's ability with words. 1932, when Wallace is editor of the Gospel Advocate, this is a part of a piece that appeared December the 29th, 1932. And I want you to just sort of step back for a second. You know, we sometimes think of all the problems in the 21st century, and we've got plenty for sure. But I want you to step back to 1932, a world in which there is no such thing as an antibiotic, where penicillin has not been invented yet, where every time a child gets sick, that child could die. You know, Scott was showing you the graveyard of the Campbell family in Bethany, West Virginia. Campbell had 8 or 10 children by his first wife. He buried every one of those children, plus his first wife. You know, think about that kind of a world. And this is titled Retrospective and Prospective. The old year is dying, the new year is dawning. It is time for reminiscence and resolution. The one relates to the past, the other to the future. Concerning the former, there are some things to be remembered and there are some things to be forgotten. It would be folly to linger, either on the summit or in the valley, except as the future may be blessed by reminiscence in the fruit of good resolutions it may yield. Someone has painted a word picture of an old man, pale and frail, standing on a bleak, icy hill, leaning in decrepitude upon the arm of his last surviving but dying child, the departing December. His sandals are old and worn, and his form is wasted. His name is the old year. To us, he is old man 1932. He belongs to a family whose genealogy presents the world with no two contemporaries. The birth of one is always preceded by the death of the other. In wailing requiems over the death of the old, dying on the air turns into the songs of lullaby over the cradle of the new. The old year is gone, but his footprints are left. Many a lovely babe fondled and caressed by a happy, hopeful mother last New Year is not here. Some beautiful girls and bounding boys whose smiles and shouts of laughter enliven the home a year ago are not with us now. Various articles of personal ownership now unclaimed, toys, books, clothing, or an empty room, are mute reminders of their presence with us and make us weep anew. An old armchair is empty in the corner. Some of us are fatherless and motherless. One and all, they gathered up our affections and carried them away, in consequence of which we love the earth less and heaven more. No year ever passes without someone dying whom we knew and loved. The name of every succeeding year is engraved upon the marble of our cemeteries. 1933 will be chiseled upon the tombstone that marks the head of some of our graves. Death is an officer that no money can bribe, that no power can resist, that no skill can evade. The pale horse and its rider cross the threshold and waft loved ones away. Whether in the bloom of youth or in the gray of years, what is your life? It is even a vapor that appeareth for a little time and then vanisheth away. Life is a vapor. So is the rainbow, so is the fog of the morning. How short and uncertain then are our days. We spend our days as a tale that is told. What kind of story are you weaving into the fabric of your life? Whether long or short, it may be worth reading. It is not the length of a life or of a story that makes it worthwhile. The greatest life that was ever lived was only 33 and a half years, and the greatest stories ever written are his parables. So we should not stay the stride of time. If we could but labor to make a life a story worth reading, whether long or short. He had a remarkable way with words, and when Brother Wallace was on, either with the pen or with the spoken word or with the touch or with the letters that he would write to people to console them, and when he was in his pastoral mode, for lack of a better way of saying it, he did some remarkable things and some things that I'm not sure most people really fully know, appreciate, and understand. One other thing that I want to share, I have been very much involved in trying to collect what's called the ephemera, the things that are for the day. And I've got some examples here that I'll just sort of briefly show. I mentioned Remember the Words of Christ. Actually first came out as a record album. This came out in 1966. On September the 30th, Wallace's 70th birthday, that was presented to him. If you don't know what this is, you're too young to probably be in this class. This is an 8-track. Lasted about 2 years. Cassette tapes, meeting cards, and then part of how you try to build writing a biography is through letters. And I have about 30 volumes of Brother Wallace's letters, letters written to Brother Wallace, and letters that individuals wrote to Brother Wallace. These are letters from 1934 that I brought as an example. It was mentioned earlier, and I'm not trying to sell a book because we sold all these out in about 8 weeks. Noble Patterson and I, Brother Patterson was a good close friend of Foy Wallace Jr. Really was like a son to him, certainly like a Timothy to Brother Wallace. And Noble published most of Brother Wallace's books from about 1965 through about 1988, I think it is. And Noble and I together combined on a book about 10 years ago. Noble wanted to print 700 copies. We were funding this with our own money, and I argued for 500 if Brother Wallace had been dead 20 years. I didn't think, you know, that many people would buy the book, but we sold them all in about 8 weeks. But saving things like letters and correspondence, I was over at the library, you know, earlier today. There's the beginnings of a really good archive here at Faulkner, and I would really encourage those of you that love history to, you know, put a little money where your mouth is and send that towards the library. They're trying to build up a good archive on the second floor of this building. There's a room dedicated to the memory of Brother Curley, who for 15 years was the editor of the Gospel Advocate. It takes money to house things, to keep things, and to make them available. And what I want to share kind of in closing, this is a personal letter that after the book came out, somebody sent me, and he had saved it on a thermofax. The original was lost, but he had a thermofax copy. Again, an antique form of a copy machine, but it was written in Brother Wallace's own hand. And I transcribed this letter and footnoted it, and I've transcribed and footnoted many, many letters. But this is Brother Wallace in his pastoral mode, and whether you agree or disagree with Brother Wallace on the particular issue at stake, I think it tells us something about Brother Wallace. And it's a letter written to Raymond Miller. And Brother Miller was a brother in Billings, Montana. And what had happened was Brother Miller, before he was a Christian, had been very briefly married and divorced. And after that, he had remarried a couple of years later, and he'd been married to his present wife for 50 years, had had a number of children. And now a preacher had come to town and had suggested that he was living in sin with that second wife. And, you know, what should he do? Was he even a Christian? Should the preacher who baptized him have inquired whether he was previously married? And all of these questions are going through Brother Miller's mind. And he writes a letter to Brother Wallace, and he signs it, signed Brother Miller. He's not even sure that he's a Christian. And this is Brother Wallace's response to Brother and Sister Miller. He says, "First, you may erase the question mark after brother in addressing me and after in Christ in your signature, for I accept you as Brother Miller, my brother in Christ. Second, in your letter, you fairly answered your questions, as it appears to me, quite correctly. The Lord did not prescribe any such course of action which a preacher referred to would bind, nor did his apostles do so in epistles to the churches in dealing with such past conditions. Restitution for sins is required only when and where restitution is possible. This is not possible in the classification of sins that are past, Romans 3:25. The incident in your life in the far past is outside restitution, but it is within remission of sins. And a preacher who makes it mandatory now for you to break up your home, separate your family, and to thus scandalize your children and destroy them is legislating his own opinion. And there is no scripture for that course of action. And it's very doubtful that in the same circumstances he would do so himself. My advice and counsel to you, as has always been to others in like circumstances, is to stay with your family, live right, be Christians, bring up your children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord in the church, and strive to go to heaven, as all of us, as full of mistakes as we are, should strive to do. In my commentary on the Sermon on the Mount, there is a section which deals with this portion of the Lord's teaching. I've marked it in the enclosed folder. It was a pleasure to have you in the meeting at Roanoke, Texas. I would be happy if such a thing should occur again. Wishing for you and yours all the blessings of divine providence, I am your friend and brother in the Lord, Roy Wallace, Jr. Well, that kind of tells you maybe a little bit of something about Foy Wallace, Jr. As I said at the outset, I mean, you could talk for a long time. I mean, I could probably go for 4 or 5 hours and never really repeat myself. But Brother Wallace had a very tender heart. He also had a very hard side. Brother Wallace once said that when I preach, am wielding the sword of the Spirit. He said, I am not a masseur. He said, I'm not a rubbing doctor. And he said, I don't want the knife to have to cut any further than it has to cut. But sometimes the knife has to cut. And I think as we look at the challenges that we all face in the 21st century, to me, the interesting thing and the thing that makes the study in the lives of those that have gone on before me so worthwhile is the fact that they really do speak to our current problems. And they do speak to the fact that in our preaching and in our teaching, it is critical that we draw the issue. It is critical that preaching and teaching do something to someone. And Brother Wallace's view, I think, was that too often preaching was just blah. It wasn't motivating people to do anything. And it wasn't inspiring people to do anything. And I think about that any time that I am teaching a Bible class or even having this kind of a conversation with folks from a historical standpoint. Are we getting anything done? Are we making each other better? You know, Solomon says, as iron sharpens iron, so a man sharpens the countenance of his friend. That's what the gospel's about, isn't it? Shouldn't it make us all better? Shouldn't it make us all more like Christ? And shouldn't we be excited every day for the opportunity to change and transform our life and make it a little more like Christ? Well, I could, as I said, I could go on a long time, but this is as good a place as any to stop. And I hope this has been interesting. And I hope it's the kind of thing that will lead you, if not to study the life of Brother Wallace, as Scott was saying earlier, you know, find the life of someone else that's been involved in how you became a Christian and look at what they did. And most importantly, let's look at the things that we can do to walk in their footsteps and to do the same kinds of things they did, because it was all about saving souls and bringing people to a knowledge of the gospel of Jesus Christ. Thank you very much.